Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to extend a very special welcome to any new members who are here tonight. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming health events. On November 19th, it's Power to the Patient, a Survivor's Perspective on Healthcare. And on November 27th, it's Changing the Way We Die. These are just two of the upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Questions can be asked by the members of the audience using microphones in the audience at the end of the program. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now to turn your cell phones and portable devices off. I'll now begin today's program. Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Adam Ghazali. Dr. Ghazali obtained his MD and PhD in neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, completed clinical residency in neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, and postdoctoral training in cognitive neuroscience at UC Berkeley. He's the founding director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UC San Francisco, an associate professor in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry, and principal investigator of the cognitive neuroscience laboratory. Dr. Ghazali has authored over 70 scientific articles, delivered almost 300 presentations, more than that now. That's okay, we're a lot more than that now. This is not that old, and it's how many? 400. Woohoo, you've been busy. Invited presentations around the world, and his research and perspectives have been consistently profiled in high-impact media, such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time, Discover, Wired, PBS, NPR, CNN, and NBC Nightly News. Recently, he wrote and hosted the nationally televised PBS-sponsored special, The Distracted Mind, with Dr. Adam Ghazali. Awards and honors for his research include the Pfizer AFAR Innovations in Aging Award, the Ellison Foundation New Scholar Award in Aging, and the Harold Bremer Pempniski Early Career Award in Neurobehavioral Science. Welcome, Dr. Ghazali. Wow. I know.
All right, let me untether that so I can walk around at least. Hello, everyone. I love being here. This is, Patty was my original host of my first talk, which was 5 years ago now?
Five.
And I think this is my sixth or seventh time here, and I always enjoy it and get to share new stuff with you. It's like a good testing ground for me to bring out some new stuff, and I'm excited to show you a vision of the future, more so than what I've done in the past. You're going to see some of that, but I really like now having the opportunity to look ahead and give you some perspective about where we're going in our lab and what we're doing next year. Thanks, Patty. All right, so let's dive right in. We have a good amount of time, and then we'll have time for questions as well. So I want to just start this by painting the broadest possible vision. Since it is more of a vision talk, I want to give you our highest level goals and then get into some of the details from there. So this is a goal that I have and my lab has for a long time, improving quality of life. And it may seem like, well, who doesn't have that goal? But I have to tell you, in my world of neurology and neuroscience, a lot of my colleagues have good goals, but some of them are different, like making us live longer. But I'm really focused. I've never really been focused on longevity. My goals have always been living better, right? So not just longer, but better. And I think that we actually pay a pretty large burden for how long we live right now. So that's really what we're trying to focus on. How do we do that? Well, I think there's a major challenge, and it's a global challenge, and it's one that we think about all the time in my lab, is how to develop approaches to improve cognition in both healthy and impaired people. And if you think about this from the perspective of the healthy, it's really the basis and should be, if it's not, the core mission of our education system, right? It's not just about transferring content. It's about improving how our brains operate and cognitive abilities. From the perspective of impaired, it's really the basis of the entire mental health care system, right? So every neurological and psychiatric disease, our goal is, again, along this line of cognition. And that's even clearer when you define cognition in a certain way. And I'll tell you how I define it, and you'll see it has that breadth. It's how our brain organizes information. That's essentially it, the processes that underlie that. And you're probably familiar with these terms. I don't know. It's not such a big screen, so I'll read them. Attention, perception, emotion, memory, decision-making, motor and language output. All of these are essentially just manipulations of information, and that's really what our brain has been evolved to do. And so if you think about cognition in this perspective, then you could see how broad the goals are of improving it in people, right? And both all the people in this room and all those that are suffering from impairment as well. How do we go about doing that? So I'm going to tell you, before we talk about the vision of the future, our current state of affairs. And sometimes I paint this from the perspective of education, and sometimes I do both. Today I'm just going to really largely focus in on a medical view in the domain that I'm closest. I'm a neurologist, so this is the type of thing that I have thought about for a long time and see these type of patients, and tell you how right now we go about enhancing cognition and the massive limitations that we face. So let's say you're a 60-year-old and you or older, but in this particular case, and you've noticed that your attention's changing, your memory's changing, and you're concerned about it. Maybe you have Alzheimer's in your family. Maybe your spouse is concerned because it's happening more frequently. I always put up this picture. It's a little small here. Can anyone see what's going on here? Do you know what's going on, right? Everyone recognize that instantly as the frustration you experience when you arrive at the refrigerator only to have no idea what you're doing there. Even though 7 seconds ago you knew exactly what you wanted, it's sort of an amazing little glitch in our brain. And, you know, in itself, I know right now you might be like, ooh, is that concerning? And but it happens to everyone. I was just reminded, sometimes these stories fly into my head. You hear I give a lot of talks. I was giving a talk to an entire audience of high school girls in Vancouver. And I decided to put up this image anyway, even though it's generally something that we think about as like the senior moment, and just to see what would happen. And I put it up and just laughter erupts because they all know about this. So this is nothing that's particular to being older. It's really a lifelong phenomena. And we've studied this for a long time, so that's why I use it as an example. It's actually usually more of an attention problem than a memory problem. That's a whole other talk, one I think I gave a couple years ago. But let's say this is happening and you're concerned and you wind up in a physician's office, like you wind up here at UCSF, as good as you get for neurology anywhere. Even at a place like this, what will happen to you? Well, the first thing is that you're going to get a very poor characterization, as sad as that is. We will likely not do detailed cognitive assessments. Maybe it'll be better if you're in a neurologist or psychiatrist's office. But the chances are that we might not understand exactly what's going on in your brain to yield this type of behavior, because we're very unlikely to do functional brain imaging. Even though we've been doing it for 15 years or longer, depending on the technique, and understand a lot about the brain from it, we don't use it clinically at all. So there's going to be a disconnect between what your experience and our ability, even at the highest level, to understand what's happening in your brain that's leading you to be frustrated to wind up in a doctor's office. And if it's concerning enough, regardless of the fact that we might not understand it, we will treat it. And how we will treat it is with one of these, right? So this is pretty much what we do. And the problem with it is that it's very poorly targeted. So it might be targeted to something as general as a neurotransmitter system, right? A drug, if you can't see in the back of them, there's a pill over here. But neurotransmitters are, while our brains use them to function, it's not really the computational unit of how our brain functions. That's a neural network or a circuit. And so the problem is, if you're trying to boost some aspect of cognition and you use one of these, you have to go to very high doses to get the effects that you're looking for, and then you get side effects. And probably the majority of what psychiatrists and neurologists do is actually treat the side effects that are caused by the very medications that we use to create effects. And that's because of this problem that we don't have very, very highly targeted medications. Big frustration to everyone, patients, doctors, even the pharmaceutical companies know about this. So that's where we stand right now. The next problem is that it's entirely non-personalized. So this person is going to get a prescription that's based on population data, which is how we figure out how to treat someone. The problem is that that population has lots of heterogeneity, right? There's lots of differences, individual differences that are not being taken into account. So this dose might not be appropriate for this person. It might be too high. It might be too low. We don't know that. We don't have a personalized approach to treating. The other problem is that we have a very unimodal solution. Many doctors will just give one medication and maybe not even tell you, like, for example, for cognitive impairment, that physical fitness is a very effective means of improving how our brain functions. So we have this siloed approach to treatment where we tend to give one, that's what we mean by unimodal, just one approach. And our brain is just too complicated to approach in such a single way. The last problem is that it's open loop. And the best way to describe to you what open loop is to tell you what closed loop is. So closed loop systems work in this way. You intervene in some way. You take some action. It doesn't have to be a biological system. It could be anything. You intervene and you record what the impact is. And then you use that data to change your intervention and then reapply it. And ideally, this happens with no latency, with zero time. And you just get this feedback loop. That's how you change things dramatically. It's sort of the opposite of how our current system works, which is very open loop. So you get this drug with all of these problems. You take it home. You take it. It might be months before you come back. And during that time, you're just getting a subjective impression of what's getting better, what are the side effects. You count that to your doctor. And then, really, in a non-evidence-based approach frequently, a decision is made to go up or down at the dose, and you start this really long cycle over again. This is a horrible way to change anything. And it's basically this, you know, the state of the art right now when it comes to this. And I would say this is just not good enough. Now, yesterday I gave a talk very similar to this, and I was in New York, and there were lots of CEOs and heads of pharmaceutical companies. And I always like to do this when they're in the audience because they just sort of go like that. Now, I don't feel that harshly about medications in general. I just largely thought that's a pretty cool effect. But I do think that we are not where we should be now. And the pharmaceutical companies know it as well as anyone else. There might be a time that we have a medication that fixes Alzheimer's disease, right? That pill, that holy grail that we've been searching for. But we don't have it, and we've been trying to do it for 50 years. Nor do we have it for any other neurological or psychiatric disease. As a matter of fact, our drugs really haven't changed in 40 years. We've just sort of been reformulating the exact same drugs. So this is not just a frustration of patients, not just a frustration to physicians. The industry is also reeling from this. And one of the big topics at yesterday's meeting is that this is recoiling of the industry, where it's too expensive now, and the chances of success have become so low that they're withdrawing their efforts in this space, which is horrible because there are so many diseases. That's occurred across multiple of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies in the world. There's only a couple that are really still pushing as hard as they were. So this is the situation we're in. So it's not a good one. So while my colleagues, like my friends at UCSF, try to figure out how to change the pathology of disease to cure them, and I want that to happen as much as anyone else, while that happens, we want to come up with a more effective approach to help keep our brains strong so that if we are invaded by something, by a pathology or even just age or even just want to boost our ability, we have the means to do that. And so what my lab is working on is a new approach that's targeted, personalized, multimodal, and closed loop. That's the idea, taking advantage and capitalizing on all of our new technology, as I'll show you, to basically fill in all of the weaknesses that we currently have. Now, I don't have this answer yet. We've done some of this, and I'll show you, but that's why it's a vision. It's really where we're going and where we're working in the lab right now to do this. But by the time we get to the end, you'll see how you can potentially have all of these things covered in one therapeutic. All right, so I'm going to give a three-step approach that we're taking to do this. It's something I've been working on for almost 20 years now, is designing this sort of pathway. So the first step is to understand the target. If we don't know the target, we can't be very targeted. And that's actually the problem, is that a lot of the meds are not really pointed at the underlying source of what they're trying to change because they don't understand them. And we've spent a long time in our lab using multiple tools like functional MRI, electroencephalography, also known as EEG, and transcranial stimulation, magnetic and electrical stimulation. And again, this is another whole discussion. I'm not going to talk about this. But what we use is these tools to figure out how neural networks lead to higher order cognitive abilities like attention and memory and how things go wrong, like why you wind up in front of the refrigerator and don't know what you're doing there. And so we've been doing that for a long time to understand what are the vulnerabilities and how our brain processes information. So then we can apply treatments that target them. The other advantage of using physiological tools like this is that we don't only get a target, but we also get functional biomarkers of those functions in our brain. These biomarkers are very important when you're developing so that you can see what the outcome of your interventions are very, very in a very careful quantitative way. So those are two advantages we get from this approach. So we've done this. A lot of our work focuses on healthy aging. You see that theme keeps coming up. And we understand that older adults, for example, have weaknesses in how they have their cognitive control abilities, things like attention, working memory, holding information in mind, multitasking, task switching. And so we know that that's a weakness. We know that it impacts the quality of their lives. And we have functional markers from MRI and EEG that tell us how these abilities are performing at a very basic level. So we had a target. The next step is to build an engine. Well, we know that all engines need fuel. So what is the fuel of our engine before I tell you how we build the engine? So the fuel of our engine is this process, this amazing phenomenon known as brain plasticity. You've probably heard this term. There was a while ago that no one heard this term, but now it's pretty common, neuroplasticity. What it is, it's the ability of our brain to modify itself at every level of resolution, from function to structure to its chemistry, all in response to interactions with the environment. This is how we learn. It's the basis of learning. For a long time, we thought that this essentially ended after critical stages of development. We now know that this continues throughout our lives. So our job is to use this as a fuel. We're not creating plasticity. We're just trying to harness plasticity and direct it in the way that we want it to go. So that's the fuel of the engine. So what's the engine? We spent a long time trying to create a whole landscape of approaches that might improve cognitive abilities. And I'm going to show you what those are now, because we don't want to miss out on anything. You can create a very tailored environment to challenge people in order to drive plasticity. This is essentially how education works, right? We have a young, very plastic brain. We put it in a very prescriptive environment so that it develops along the way society wants it to at the very end, right? That's essentially what we're doing. It's cognitive enhancement using an environment, and then there's other approaches like meditation and training in enriched environments. We could use medications. Even though they're not targeted, we know that they work on neurotransmitter systems and can boost cognitive abilities like Ritalin and Adderall for ADHD, modafinil for narcolepsy, and Aricept for Alzheimer's disease. And despite the fact that these were developed for clinical conditions, we know that they can also boost cognition in people that are healthy. So I'm reminded of all these talks now. Just mid last week, I was giving a talk at UC Berkeley for an engineering class, giving a class on brain-computer interfaces. And so I had a room full of 20-year-olds, and I was talking about this, and I was looking around the room when I was talking about it. I don't know if, see, people here are laughing. No one there was laughing at all. They had the straightest faces. I'm like, I know some people in this room are using Adderall for grades. I mean, it's a very, very well-known phenomena across campus, especially high-intensity places like Berkeley, that these medications, which boost neurotransmitter systems, are used to boost cognition and and college students use it to get an edge. It's not really being used recreationally. It's really being used as a cognitive enhancement. So we should keep this on the list of pharmaceutical approaches to improve cognition. Then we know that things that are good for your body are good for your brain, physical exercise, nutrition. We also have other approaches that we're interested in. I'm going to come back to this later. But what neurofeedback is being able to see and hear how your own physiology is changing gives you control over it through closed loop, and this is related to biofeedback, and I'll come back to it. We could stimulate the brain electrically or magnetically, either at the scalp or deep implantable electrodes like these, direct brain-computer interfaces. For example, in Parkinson's disease, these are implanted in the brain and can literally just stop tremors on a dime. These have also been shown to improve cognitive abilities. So you can even stimulate at the level of the scalp with an electrical current while someone's going through a learning procedure and wind up with a better learning curve. We have a paper right now that's in review that uses that approach. And then there are video games. This is where we're going to spend some time. Everyone likes this topic. So video games. I just want to pause and you know, I think that most of you are probably aware, if you're not, that video games are not what they used to be at all, right? We know that the entire profile has shifted. They're almost completely ubiquitous now. We have pretty much a 50-50 gender balance of video games in the world, males, females. We have the average age of a gamer pretty close to 40, and that's not just because young gamers like myself have become old gamers, but because games are being targeted for different populations than they were a while ago. We know that they're completely global, and they're a massive multi-billion dollar industry, equal in our country to both the greater than the entertainment and the music industry, the movie and the music industry put together. So it's a big, giant, powerful industry. Why? Because it is probably the most powerful form of media that is. It's interactive, and it's fun. And so we have a very powerful tool that that can influence behavior. And right now it's really almost entirely directed at entertainment. But we ask the question, and many others do, can games have a positive impact? Can we take advantage of the fact that they can induce behaviors, which we know they can, and that's why we use them so much, to have a positive impact? And there's been lots of thoughts about this. I actually found this viewpoint from Time magazine in the early days of video games, saying that video games are just another manifestation of human mania, our endearing quality of going relentlessly after absolutely pointless goals. So that's Time magazine 1982, and if you played video games back in the 80s, you know, that was probably fairly true. I mean, it was definitely the early days. I think it was still Pong then, but times have changed a lot. Now, I know some people, maybe even some people in this room, still believe this, but I can tell you that there's a giant industry around the world that are looking at video games for impact across many different domains, from education to motivation to persuasion to physical health and to cognitive health. I'm just going to just pause on this one interesting finding that started an entire field from 2002 on. So what you're looking at here is a picture of a game that's known as a first-person shooter. Does anyone play first-person shooters in this room? Okay, a couple people. If you don't, that's fine, but you should really take a look at one. What one looks like. I think you'll be absolutely amazed. It basically looks like you're looking at a high-level motion picture, like the top, like the best Hollywood has to offer, except you're in it, but you can't see yourself. You're actually looking at it from a first-person view and navigating it, and it's just absolutely amazing. And what it was found in 2002, that the young people that play these games, if you take them into the laboratory and you do a whole battery of tests of cognitive control abilities, like attention, speed of processing, resistance of distraction, task switching, they excel off the charts compared to those kids that don't play. And then if you take naive people that don't, and largely college students that don't play these games, pretty much all of them are women, then you find that you can improve these very skills if you compare it to like other control games like Tetris. So this has led to this entire industry showing that these type of action video games have this ability to improve our cognitive control. And so we ask the question, can we take this concept, strip away the violence, which is a big source of contention for those type of games, and develop custom-designed video games to enhance cognitive control abilities in older adults. So this is exactly the engine that we decided to start with, to take advantage of something that was already a message out there that this can change cognitive abilities. But if we did it from scratch and we targeted it towards deficits in this population that we knew so well from all of our imaging work over the years, can we improve some of these skills? So that's what we did. So I reached out to friends of mine in the video game industry. This is actually George Lucas's company, LucasArts, which is unfortunately no longer with us as of last year. And I asked them if they would be interested in coming down to the lab. These are friends of mine, and recruit some of their awesome friends from that world and help us build a video game that I had come up with the design in my mind. But I knew that we didn't have the skills in our lab to build it. So if they could help us build it and figure out how to do that in such a way that we can then test it, could we go through a very careful set of tests to see what impact it had on the older brain? So this is NeuroRay, so let me just show you what it looks like. What you're essentially doing is driving a car along a road. It's really hard to keep your car on the road. You have to go left, right, depending on the turns, up, down. You have to pull back on the joystick. And then you have to respond as rapidly and accurately to these signs. So green circles, not red circles, not green pentagons, which are pretty hard not to press to. And you do these two tasks at the same time. Now, just a little bit about what's under the hood there is that each of these tasks use what we call staircase adaptive algorithms. And by that, I mean that when you play the game is recording your performance, it's recording your response time, your accuracy, and then it's adjusting its difficulty level on the fly using these algorithms so that it holds you right at a challenging part of engagement where it's not too hard, that it's frustrating, not too easy, where it's boring. You don't have to put in whether you're 7 or 70 years old. The game will figure out your ability level and challenge you right at that level all the time. And we think that's the way that you harness plasticity. You push it right at that sweet spot, and you just don't let go. And so that's how the game works. Now, if you played this game, whether you were aware of it or not, what you would want to do, what you would do, is you would really trade off. It's very hard to do these two things at the same time. So you get better at driving or better at the sign task and just sort of let the other one go. How we get around that, because we want your brain to figure out how to do these at the same time, is that we use rewards to tether across the adaptive loops. So, for example, in this game, you never level up in the game, and everyone wants to level up, even if you're 80 years old. You don't level up unless both of these skills improve. So that's really how we keep that motivation to get both of these better. So that's a little bit of the methodology behind NeuroRacer. So NeuroRacer was built. It took us a year to build this game. So we work with this team. I discovered that if you supply sushi and beer, you can have all these amazing game professionals come down to your lab and work for free. They told me that the reason they do it is because they've been teaching teenagers how to kill aliens for almost 10 years now, a decade, and they're ready to do something different. So, you know, these are incredibly talented people that have been focused on building these entertainment games. They wanted to take their skills and bring it into this world. So that's NeuroRacer. So what I'm going to do quickly is give you a snapshot of some data from the paper that we published on it. So after the game was built, that was 2009, it took us a year to build the game, and then it took us 4 years to do studies on it. So we did multiple experiments, and I'm just going to give you a snapshot of that. So what you're looking at here is from 20 years old to 80 years old, and this is your ability to multitask on the game. What 0% means is that you do as well when you do the sign task that I showed you alone, as well as when you also drive at the same time. Right? That's perfect. And then everything below this is the percent of cost that you pay by multitasking, how much you drop. So 20-year-olds, and again, I'm reminded of the talk at Berkeley last week, asking them, you know, how do they think they would do it this? And you just see these incredibly smug expressions on 20-year-olds. I don't know if there's any in the room, because they do believe strongly that they are multitasking masters. They're like, we practice this all day long. It's how we live. We will do perfectly on this. But when you test them, what you find is that they drop around 27%. So that's the performance on the sign task when they're also driving compared to the sign task alone. Now, we already know that older adults, like 70-year-olds, do not do very well in multitasking. We had published a dozen papers. So we knew that. But what we were interested and what no one had shown yet is what happens in between. Right? Do you just maintain these abilities your whole life and then plummet in one horrible year when you're 69 years old? And that's not what happens. You plunge every single year. So this is the curve of what it looks like. Actually, the biggest difference between two adjacent decades are between 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And at that, I noticed the smug expressions disappear from their faces, because some of them are like, ooh, that's going to be me pretty soon. So this is sort of the peak that we see. Interestingly enough, I guess I don't have it on this slide, but if you look at 8 to 12-year-olds, they come out at around the age of 35. So they're over here. So it's a skill that is built and then declines. And what we see with this is that we could use a video game that we created in our lab as a diagnostic, a performance behavioral diagnostic, to pick up very sensitive differences, even differences between healthy 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. What we can then do next is use the game as a neural diagnostic. So the other challenge that we faced is that we built the game so that we can also record neural activity during gameplay, both inside an MRI scan, which was quite tricky, and with EEG. And so what we see is, so here's one of our participants with a 64-channel wireless EEG cap, so we could pick up these signals in her brain while she plays. And then we find that we get this burst of activity that you see right over here. It's a low frequency. It's called theta. And it happens during the most challenging part of the game, when you're driving and a sign comes up. So you're driving along, trying to keep your car on the road. Sign comes up. Within a third of a second, you get this burst of low frequency activity that we could record from the front of your brain that dissipates over the course of a second. So if we take a look at the brains of 20-year-olds, I hope you can all see this. This is the nose up here. These are the ears on the side. And you're looking down on the head. And this is a power spectrum. So this peak over here, you could see it goes from the cooler colors to the yellow, is this burst. This is a third of a second after the sign comes up. And that's what a 20-year-old, and pretty much looks that way very consistently across that age group. If you take a look at a 70-year-old's brain, this is what you find. So it's a burst, right? I mean, it's definitely outside of the blue level, but it's sort of like only halfway up the power spectrum. You could see there's a big age difference, and that's very significant. So the first question we asked was, let's take a group of older adults. We actually had a collaboration with Apple at the time, and we distributed laptops around the Bay Area. We had three groups, and they played NeuroRacer in this adaptive mode, the multitasking mode, for 1 month. So they played it for an hour a day, 3 days a week for 1 month, and we used Dropbox to collect their data remotely so we could see them play at home when we were in lab. We have one of our experimenters here right now. Nice to see you walk in. And what we found was that 1 month later, looking at what happens in their brain and what happens to their performance was this. So they got a lot better, remarkably so. It's even more impressive when you actually see someone play after 12 hours of gameplay. They actually exceed the abilities in their multitasking on the game compared to the 20-year-olds on a single visit. But to me, what's most impressive is how different their brains are. You could see this peak. This is not just a higher level. It happens earlier. It occurs to a larger part of their brain. It lasts longer. And so we get this really profound change in how their brain activates really rapidly, which is very exciting. If you take a look at 6 months later, they haven't played the game, we find that this skill to multitasking game has not even declined significantly. We actually didn't realize that we'd find something like that. We just sort of checked because we were curious. But if we had thought that that was true, we would have done a lot more surveillance at what's going on to sustain this ability 6 months later without even boosting it. But it's something we're looking at more carefully now. The other thing we find is that there's benefits in other skills. And this was our main hypothesis, that by putting pressure on this system that we know is so vulnerable and so hard for older adults to do to multitask, if they got better at it, we would see improvements in other skills that are related to it, like working memory, holding information of a face in mind for short periods of time, and a skill that we call attention span or sustained attention, which is holding their attention in a very boring, a very impoverished environment, very different than gameplay. So we do these tests before and after, and we show that this group improves not just on the gameplay, but in these other tasks that are, while related, were not directly targeted. There were two control groups. One group was a no-contact control. They just came in before and after just to see what the practice effects were, and they didn't show any improvement in these. And then we had another group that we think was a very good control group. What they did was they played the game for 12 hours, NeuroRacer, but they played it in single-task mode. So they only did the sign task and the driving task one at a time, 3 minutes of sign, 3 minutes of drive, but never at the same time. And they didn't show any of these effects. The effects were driven by the act of multitasking and gameplay. That is what we needed to do in order to push on their neural processes to get these effects. And that's why it's not that anything that you do for your brain is going to be equally good for it. And this is a very popular and controversial topic right now about brain training and games and these type of things. We know our brains are plastic, but it doesn't change so easily. It'd be very dangerous if our brains just change very easily. We think that you have to apply strong applied pressure for a long period of time, and we use adaptivity and feedback loop and the deep immersion and engagement of rewards that we get in our video games. So that's what we built. Another thing that I think is the most exciting part of this paper was what I call a neural bridge, right? If you get transfer like we saw over there, why does it happen? It's not a magic trick, right? You can't go from this box to that box. You have to have some connector that bridges them. What we find is that those older adults that showed the biggest change in their brain from before to after, right? So not everyone shows the same amount of change, but those that showed the biggest change, they showed the transfer of benefits. They showed the improvement in the other domain. They showed the biggest improvement on the attention test, and they also showed the best preservation of their multitasking ability on the game 6 months later. So this was our goal, to start understanding what are the mechanisms that you can put pressure on to lead to improvement in other skills and lead to sustainable effects. So that's what we found there. And so our conclusions from this study were that adaptive training of interference processing, right? It was the interference that drove it, because that was the difference between our control group and our main hypothesis training group, drives enhancements of cognitive control, at least some tasks in older adults, and that it happens due to changes in the prefrontal cortex, the most evolved part of our brain, the last part of our brain to develop, and also its networks with the rest of the brain. I didn't show you that data. So that's essentially the story. We were really, really delighted when this was published in Nature last year, which to us is as high as it gets. If you're a musician, it's like the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. And it was exciting. I mean, it was a 5-year project. It was very high risk. This is as high a reward as a scientist can ever get. But it was also very complicated, and I show you this cover for one particular reason. You could see that the name Game Changers on it, and that's what the journal put on it, and it's sort of a pun, but, you know, it's a good pun for us, right? And, you know, it was exciting, it's intimidating, but it really tortured me because it led me to go through months of messaging to the media globally that it's not this game that I think is the game changer. Like, I'm proud of this game. We're really happy with the effects. But if there's a game changer here, what I hope it is that you can learn about deficits in a population and then build in a customized way, working with professionals in the industry, something like a video game that targets those deficits and then study it in a very carefully controlled way with neural measures for outcomes to understand mechanism. It's a long process. It took us 5 years to do this. But if there's any changer that's really going to make a difference, it's that others start building and validating in this careful way that's expensive and takes a long time. Because it's the only way that we'll start creating other type of therapeutics besides drugs. That's what I believe. So anyway, that's what we're hoping will happen. So now I'm going to tell you two stories. That's it. No more data, just fun stuff from here on in. I'm going to tell you about two pathways that we're now pursuing to take what you just saw there to the next level. The first is we want to move it out of the lab, right? So we know very well that you cannot build a product in an academic lab, right? Even building that sort of 1980-style game that we built was really challenging. But if you want to build something that's really accessible and scalable and really could reach people, especially at a global level, which is our goals, you got to figure out how to couple academics with industry. And so some of what I've done to do that is first file the patent behind it, because that's really important, that protectable property if you want companies to be invested in it and care about it. And so UCSF owns a patent that I filed that has the methodology that I described to you behind NeuroRacer. And then I helped co-found a company. Actually, my friends that worked at LucasArts now work at this company. They actually left just before LucasArts left. And they are now taking all their high-level skills and building AAA, you know, video games for many years and bringing that to this type of development. So there's a game, it's called Evo. It's designed by this company, Achille. I really serve as an advisor for the company and let them go and take it from there. And I just want to show you what it looks like. I don't think we have any. Maybe I'll put my microphone here because I don't think there's any audio connection, and try to show you what it looks like. And the main reason I show it to you is so that you can understand how important this academic industry relationship is. What a game can look like in the lab, which you saw, and you know, it worked, it had effects, to what you can build when you work with professionals that are devoted full time to building this and work along with scientists to keep that relationship between the game aspect of it and the science. So let me show you this. I think you can hear it. The sound's not so critical. So it's now on an iPad. This makes it much more accessible. The play with the iPad is much more, for younger and older adults, a much better usability and interface. The main goal is to bring on high levels of art, music, and story. So especially if you don't have things like violence in certain populations, like young boys, you really need to have these elements and other populations that enjoy that. You could see the navigation is now done with the iPad, but it's the same tasks. It's the sign task and it's the navigation task, high rewards, same mechanisms of only getting the reward when both of them go up. So you keep the science in, but you bring on much higher levels of gameplay. Now it adapts every second, and unlike NeuroRacer, you actually move through different worlds that challenge you in different ways, that push on your cognition. So you could see the navigation path gets more complicated. If you test 8 to 12-year-olds, the only thing they want to do is customize their avatars, and so you give them that. But apparently that's critically important for kids to be involved in games, so it has that. So these are some of the design principles that you take away when you work with professionals and then bring it into the world of science and keep all that together. So what happens now? So can you just go on the App Store, as I'm asked every single day, and download it? No, this is the sort of frustrating part of the talk. So what the company has decided to do, and it is a bold move, and it is certainly polarizing, not everyone feels the same way about it, is that there are a ton of studies going on now to see if you can take this video game and make it a diagnostic and therapeutic that will penetrate this industry, right? So right through FDA pathway, can you get essentially a prescribable video game? And so there's all these studies going on, ADD, depression, TBI, so data on this today, very exciting, Alzheimer's and autism. I'm not a primary on any of these studies. It's sort of like it has left me, and it's more important for my colleagues to now validate it. And these studies will take some time, but we hope even next year to start seeing some of these milestones reached. And if it can reach FDA approval, if it can reach the same level of efficacy with minimal side effects to a drug or a medical device, then there's a chance that this might actually be used as a therapeutic. We might see a real change in the landscape about how we treat a lot of neurological and psychiatric diseases. At least that's what we hope. So maybe one day I'll be back here in the future to give a talk and tell you about what happens with all this. And so this has really left me, right, and my lab as it moves on to be validated by other groups. And that's important to do. And I would say that it's sort of like left us with the empty nest syndrome. We had this baby that went off to college. It's best served by me not going to college with it and hanging out with it all the time. Have to let it go on its own path. So what do we do in the meanwhile? Well, we could create new babies. And that's basically what I'm going to tell you now is we were really empowered by that study, and we wanted to take the momentum that we had, you know, at a very high level, a lot of interest was raised by the Nature paper, and see what can we do that's really out there, right? That was sort of out there. It was definitely left of center. No one had ever seen a lab build a video game like that and take it all the way to a Nature paper. But what is even a bigger level of achievement? So this is where living in the Bay Area is really a benefit to me. I have tons of friends that work at amazing companies where they have just off-the-charts levels of innovation and technology. Most of that technology is positioned in the entertainment and communications and media space, right? But what if we can form relationships with them and partner with them and get that in our lab during the developer stage? Can we start developing tools to accomplish our goals, as I already described, that use video games but take it to the next level? And so that was the goal that I had starting around a year ago. And then I realized I didn't actually have a lab to do the experiments that I was coming up with. And no one had that lab. And I traveled all around the world looking for that lab, and it didn't really exist. Inside of a neuroscience or a psychiatry or a neurology clinic, but it did exist inside game labs to some degree. And so we built a lab called the Neuroscape Lab that we just finished in March. This is our building at Mission Bay. It's very close to here. It's a brand new neuroscience building. This is where my office and my lab is. My lab's on the fifth floor. We just moved in here a year and a half ago. And this is what the Neuroscape Lab looks like, right? So not if you're familiar with scientific labs, you would be surprised. If not, you'd be like, oh, that's a nice rec room. But what you really have here is that we have this experimental room where people engage in these interactions with the media that we create to challenge their brains and both understand it and to change it. And then right on the other side of this wall is this room, and this is our control room. And what the control room does, it allows us to present this, but also record everything that's happening to that person, from their eye movements, to their body movements, to their EEG brain activity, to their skin response, to the heart rate variability, to their performance. If we can record it, we do. And so that's the idea, is to get a really multimodal view of how someone is engaging in the games that we build over time. So this creates two really high-level engineering problems for us. A, we have to build video games that are much higher level to take advantage of this type of room, and we also need to record data that's coming in all different time scales, right? And we have to put it all in one space so we can make sense of it. So this is what we're doing now. So I'm just going to tell you quickly about some technology that we're really focusing on and excited about. It's undeniable that mobile and wireless technology is really exciting to us, largely because it's so accessible. So we spend a lot of time on tablets and phones and things that we know we can get out around the world and collect data wirelessly. So I'm going to show you about some of that. But we're also really interested in sensors and hardware like mobile EEG. So for almost a year now, we've been working with several hardware companies around the world to see if we can help them build an EEG set so that we could record neural data while people are at home. That's what we want to do. We're pretty much there. We'll probably start our first study, hopefully, maybe even before the end of this year, where people will take our video games home on things like iPads as opposed to laptops now, make them more movable, and put one of these on and send their data, both their behavioral data and their brain data, to our lab wirelessly. That has not been done yet, but that's what we're hoping to do so we can understand plasticity as it evolves over time, while you're in your home, in a real-world environment. So that's going on. right now. The other thing is we're very excited about two other pieces of technology. One, which is now in the consumer world, and the other, which is not there yet, but getting very close. So virtual reality, is everyone here familiar with this, Oculus Rift, right? So especially people in this time, Facebook now, sorry. For those that don't know, this company is creating a beautiful virtual reality goggles that is just amazing. We actually have both the first and now the second developer kit in our lab. If you put it on, it's really just jaw-dropping. I mean, you're in this rich, beautiful world that you can look around in, and Facebook just recently acquired this company for $2 billion, which is amazing because they don't actually have a product yet. But they're working on one, and it is pretty cool. So I understand why. If I had extra $2 billion, I would have done the same thing. What you're looking at here is an Oculus Rift with a 64-channel mobile EEG cap that we're very excited about. You see, none of this is tethered in except this, so hopefully that'll disappear eventually. This is actually Mickey Hart, who's the drummer from the Grateful Dead and a big collaborator of our lab, and you could see he's playing a game that I'm going to tell you about in a second. So virtual reality, we're very excited about. Wide field of view, depth, there's lots of things, more real-world experience. The other is motion capture. The ability to play a game with not just your thumb and your whole body is very interesting to us for lots of reasons, and I'll explain that in the context of one of our games. So I just want to mention one other thing that we're building. We're really excited about building cognitive assessments that can be done mobily, right? Because once we pull this off, and we're working on this for over a year now, that we can test your cognitive abilities using the same adaptive approach that we built for our video games, but not to train your brain, just to sample how your brain is working. If we can pull that off, and once we have that, then we don't actually have to meet all the people in our studies, right? Then we could test 1,000 people, 10,000, 100,000 people, because we could start distributing the things that we build mobily and use these as pre- and post-outcome measures. So that's one of the big challenges now, is that we need to bring everyone down to the lab to understand what happens in their brain before and after. So that's something that we're working on as well. So now I just want to tell you about some new games, all right? So we've been working on these for over a year now, and they won't be done this year, unfortunately. It takes a long time to build games, but I'm going to tell you about four of them. And just give you a snapshot of them. So one that I'm very excited about, I actually played it this afternoon, is called Body Brain Trainer. And the idea behind this game is that you could train yourself both cognitively and physically at the same time. I'm just going to give you a quick peek at what it looks like. So this is play in the Neuroscape lab. This is a big 85-inch plasma brain recording going on at the same time. You're interacting in this environment that's pushing on both the cognitive as well as physical demands. You see, you're using your whole body to respond to this. So while we challenge you, attention, working memory, and all these domains, we also challenge you physically. The idea is that your benefits, cognitive benefits, will be greater if you move, if you're embodied, if you're physically challenged, than if you're just sitting there using your thumbs. And that really has not been proven, not carefully yet. And so that's what we're doing there. There's a game that we're building called Rhythmicity. We're probably 6 weeks away from being completed. This is a game that's in collaboration with Mickey Hart and some other friends of mine, like Rob Garza, is working on, actually just gave us the first track for this game. And the idea behind it is to improve the rhythmic ability of the brain by making you more rhythmic. So we know that our brains are rhythmic by nature, and we know that it underlies our higher cognitive abilities. The idea is that if we could make you more rhythmic, will your brain be more rhythmic, and will you have an improvement in your cognition? No one knows that for sure yet, which is amazing, right? Because for over 1,000 years, hundreds of cultures have used rhythm and music in different ways as therapeutic tools. And yet there's not really a study that looks, if you take someone, figure out how rhythmic they are, and look at them after rhythmic entrainment experience, what happens to them. So this game is still in development. This is a virtual reality version. But the idea is we could teach you to synchronize, syncopate, reproduce, even create rhythms, use the game algorithms of feedback and adaptivity, and then see what happens to your brain before and after, and even during the process. The next is called Virtual Surround. This is, I have the least to share with you because this is still in the sort of the concept art and design phase. This is a virtual reality game that's meant to do something different than most attention games. So a lot of attention games teach you how to focus. This does the opposite. It teaches you how to distribute your attention like a net, right? So we know that we have to interact with the world. There's lots of information, especially when we're driving. So if we could take advantage of virtual reality's wide field of view and depth, can we put you in this sphere and then challenge you and give you cues and teach you how to make your attention broader and broader over time? So that's what that game is. And then the last one I want to tell you is one called Metatrain. And this one is great. I've been starting to play this one as well. And essentially what Metatrain is a game that I designed that was inspired by the principles of concentrative meditation that are integrated with the game dynamics of feedback and adaptivity. A unique aspect of this is that first, it was funded by the NIH as a pilot study that we completed. And now through a pretty unique collaboration with industry, Zynga, is as a philanthropic venture, is building the game for us. So I designed it, Zynga's building it. Jack Kornfield, who's a really amazing master in the world of meditation, many of you are nodding. It's quite a privilege and humbling to work with Jack on this. He actually helps narrate the beginning of it, and it's really great to get his insights in it. And this game is pretty much done. We're really just working on the back end to make sure we could collect all the data in the field, and then we'll go through and see if we could document how baby stepping into self-regulating your ability to resist internal distraction will have benefits on other aspects of cognition and stress and sleep and all those things. Okay, one other thing I want to tell you. We're very interested in some data that showed that exposure to nature can help restore cognitive abilities, that when you fatigue, we're very familiar with physical fatigue, right? When you work out, you do anything, you're like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. But your brain gets exhausted too. There's very little data on understanding how we can restore our cognitive abilities. But there is some data that shows exposure to nature, and it doesn't even have to be if you're in nature. Even seeing nature, hearing nature can help restore cognitive abilities, as well as its benefits on stress and other things. So when you play our games, you are in there. It is exhausting, especially body-brain trainer, because it's challenging both physically and cognitively. The idea behind this, and we played this a little bit today, is that in the break periods along the game, instead of doing nothing, which is what everyone does, you immerse yourself in this beautiful nature world. There's even a virtual reality to it. And you could use motion capture and flow through it. We're actually now working on having some stretching and some balance that takes you in this period to help restore you, and then you go back into the gameplay. And the idea is that if you don't restore, you can't engage deeply again. And we think that we'll test different break periods, like nature versus the break that we all take, which is, you know, email and check texts, and see that the learning curve is dictated not just by what we're training, but by what you do to restore yourself in break periods. So that's what that's all about. All right, where are we up to? Okay, so just to give you the sort of overview of what I told you, we have these approaches, the meditation game, the rhythm game, the attention game, our physical fitness, cognitive body-brain trainer. All of these will start as research studies using the same blueprint and methodology that you saw in the Nature paper. How are you doing on every level, from MRI, EEG, sleep, stress levels, before, take you through a long training period, and then look what the outcome is. And what we'll be able to understand with this is how to better harness plasticity in the brain across all of these domains. But what I think is the big win, and I'm not going to be able to talk about this with confidence for like probably at least another 5 years, is how these work together. So I don't think any of these are going to be like a holy grail. So this is what I'm starting to call it around the lab, neuro-CrossFit training, that you can work on all of these in like an integrated way to lead to improvements. Now, I would love to say that I'm just doing this for science, but that's not entirely true. And I'm not really doing it entirely for you. I'm doing it for myself also, right? So I want to play all of these games, and I figure this is a little time for, you know, harmless self-experimentation until we know how these all interact. So I'll be playing all of these games starting in January, you know, as often as possible, to see what it feels like to go through this sort of multimodal training across all these domains. You know, we don't know what will happen, but I do want to say that I have some really high-level expectations of what we might see, sort of like neuro Iron Man. So we'll see. Only time will tell. All right. So I want to conclude. We're wrapping up with the really out there stuff that we're doing. So if you thought that was pushing it, what were sort of like the X Labs that we have is the things that we're doing to take those video games and bring them to the next level. So it's important to note that we only look at the video games as an activator of the networks, right, in a selective way. And that's why we think that they're effective, right? So they build the networks in the brain, they activate it selectively. But we think we could use other approaches like neurofeedback and neuromodulation to then boost the effects to levels that we've never seen. So that's what we're working on now, and I want to show you what that means. In order to do this, we need new technology, and that's what we've been working on for a while. So this is called the glass brain, You might have seen it. If you Google it, you will find lots about it, including this viral YouTube video that we posted. It doesn't even have sound, but it's an interesting concept. And what you're looking at here is a project that was a collaboration between our lab, a lab at UCSD called the Swartz Center, and NVIDIA, the company that builds GPU chips. And what this is an MRI image of someone in the lab. So it has both the structures connecting them, these fibers, as well as the surface structure. And then we overlay EEG signals. This is with a 64-channel wireless cap, and do numerous computations in real time. We get rid of the artifacts. We find the sources of where these signals come from using the MRI data. And we do this approach called multivariate Granger causality, which allows us to see how areas might be interacting with each other. And then once we see that, we can overlay it on the scaffolding of the fibers that connect the different brain areas. And so you wind up with this really beautiful 3D structure. We then take this into our Unity game engine where we do all of our development, and you could just navigate through a brain in this way, a functioning brain, and you know, even if it's your brain, you can sort of fly through it. Now, this is not really a movie. What you're looking at is just a recording of us with a joystick just navigating through the brain. So we're excited about it. It's not perfect. It's really a proof of concept, but it's something that we've been working on for a long time, and now we want to take this to the next level, and I'll show you what we're going to use this for, but first I thought it's fun to show you a little fun video. So this is Mickey Hart, from the percussionist from the Dead, and he is playing. This is at a talk that I gave, a keynote at NVIDIA. So picture like 3,000 people here. This screen actually is 150 feet long. So over here, you'd be looking at what Mickey was seeing. So he was playing a video game in virtual reality. He's in this beautiful world. He's playing. Tim Mullen, one of our head engineers, is over here. He's wearing a virtual reality headset too, but he's flying through Mickey's brain, which you're seeing over here. So we have sort of like a neuro-nested dolls, right? Like Mickey's in virtual reality playing a video game, and Tim is inside Mickey's brain flying through. So it's just a proof of concept, but a fun one, and a payback to NVIDIA for all the help they gave us in building this. But that's sort of what Tim's perspective is as he flies through. So there's potentials that might be a diagnostic, that a physician, a therapist might sit down with a patient someday, have them play a game that's challenging them a certain way, and fly through their brain to understand it. And that's something that we're interested in. But what we're most interested in is using it as a closed loop. So first I want to say that we already do closed loop therapeutics in the lab. That's what NeuroRacer is. That's what all of our games are, right? Even without the neural data, something happens in your brain which induces a behavior. That behavior is recorded by the game in real time, and then that's fed back through these adaptive algorithms to challenge you appropriately. So that is why we think what we're building is effective in changing the brain, because it has low latency. It's a closed loop, just like I described it. What we hope to do is use things like the glass brain to collect neural data in real time so that essentially the game, the software, will understand where are the weaknesses and how your brain is processing information, and then use that information to change the gameplay so that the feedback and the adaptivity is not just built on your performance, but it's built on what's going on in your brain. And we think with that we'll have like a gamma knife, the ability to focus the gameplay and refine processes that are weak in a way that we can't without that data. The other thing we hope to do is to use this neural data to stimulate the brain. So this cap over here, each of these electrodes can be used to both record and stimulate the brain. So what we want to do is, if you have a weakness in, for example, how your brain is producing theta, we can record that, and then at those moments in time when your brain should have a burst of theta, we can actually apply theta with AC current. And so that's an experiment that we're working on now to boost the effects of our game, both through neurofeedback and through brain stimulation. And so the basic wrap-up slide is, you know, putting it all together, is in 2014, you have a cognitive deficit and you present with it and you get a drug, right, which activates your entire brain. That's the problem, is that we don't have selectivity. What we hope is that even in 5 years, as we continue to work on this, we'll be able to maybe remove them, but at least reduce the doses, decrease the side effects, and then use a game that's targeted to a deficit in that population to activate a circuit. Then take neural data, feed it into the game mechanics to potentiate that very circuit. We also hope that we'll be able to then take neural data, feed it to one of these stimulators, and then use that to drive increased plasticity. And maybe this would only be if you had a stroke or a traumatic brain injury and you needed extra plasticity, but we don't know. We don't understand fully how this will fit in, but this is the approach we're going for. And so what you wind up with here is something that's targeted, right? Because we have all of these very specific targets that we know are associated with cognitive abilities. It's personalized, right? It automatically adjusts itself to that individual. And it's more than personalized. It changes over time with that person. It's multimodal. We can act in multiple different levels at the same time, and it can even be used in as an adjunct to medication. And it's multiple closed loops going at the same time, pushing each other and interacting. So what we hope and what has already started is that over the next 10 years, we'll build the technology in our lab. We'll validate it. We'll do the basic proof of principles. And that's all we really did with NeuroRace, right? We got a signal. It has to be done at a bigger level and look for real-world transfer. All that has to happen. But while that's happening and we're doing that, we'll be sending these games to our colleagues that work on all these conditions. And this is not like a theoretical list. All of these conversations have already started between myself and my colleagues. So then they will take this technology and see, can it have an impact on these diseases? And we're not necessarily saying that it's going to cure them, that it's going to change the underlying pathophysiology, for example, of Alzheimer's disease. But we do think that this potential across all these conditions to improve how the brain processes information and to decrease the type of side effects that we see with our current treatments. Then there's, of course, the really big, big high-level view of what does this mean to education. Can this really help improve how we process information as we go through development or any year, even if we're healthy, just to improve how our brains operate? I think that's it. Thank you so much.
I think I should close it out and then do that afterwards, don't you think? We're going to do some Q&A. We're going to do some Q&A, but since we've already been an hour, I'm going to close the event out for tonight. Let me do my gavel thing, and then we'll take your Q&A, okay? All right. So I have to do this again. Our great thanks to Dr. Adam Ghazali for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Where does luminosity fit in this whole thing?
Usually it's at least three questions before I get that one. Okay, we'll start with that. I think it's been almost, I'm counting somewhere, at least my last 25 talks that I have gotten the same questions, you know, shows you how powerful marketing could be. I feel very tormented with that question, as you can tell, because largely I feel like, you know, you have to make a decision. Either you're going to do primary research like we're doing and devote your time to this, or you could become Consumer Reports, and that's not what I want to do. So I'm in the field. I'm not here to evaluate everyone else's products. But I will answer it in this way. Interesting. I just thought of something else. So let me answer it, and then I'm going to give you a new answer, the first time I gave this answer ever. First I would like to say is that I'm not talking about lumosity in particular. I'm going to just talk in general. And this doesn't just apply to brain games. It applies to everything that you're told helps you. There's two types of things that could happen in that domain. It could be based on science, or it could be validated by scientific methodology. And these are very different things. It's easy to base things on science. I mean, we had a blackboard here. We could base 100 things on science. As a matter of fact, things that aren't based on science are pretty rare, I think. What's really challenging is to validate something by scientific method, which is what you saw that we did, and that takes a long time and costs a lot of money. And if you're not being regulated, you might not do that. So it's important to understand when the word science is used, which is what makes people like my colleagues very uncomfortable, when it's used as a marketing tool, it's complicated. So that's just a general statement about the field, any other things you talked about. Unfortunately, there's really no Consumer Reports, although Sharp Brains has some good reviews of different products. Actually, I'm speaking for them, I think, next week, and I have for many years, and they are acting like a sort of Consumer Reports of the field. So you can go there and learn more about what people feel about it, what data exists. The other thing is we have a consensus statement. I was on a committee of 75 scientists from around the world that got together and tried to give a viewpoint about the field of brain training and what we think. I was probably the most conservative in the room that felt that there is something really important here and that we should be careful and not throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. But I can tell you, you can read about this. It was from Stanford and the Max Planck in Germany, and it's everywhere. It'll be all over the news. I think I'll be in an article in New York Times Magazine on Sunday about it. And there's plenty of, if you look in consensus and video game and brain training. But basically, I can tell you that this concern broadly from the field that claims are overinflated in relative to the science. That's the general consensus statement, but you could read the whole thing.
Okay.
Now that's done.
What was the name of that magazine you just mentioned?
Oh, this Sunday? New York Times Magazine.
Good.
So New York Times Magazine this Sunday will have a big piece, and you'll hear a lot about largely what I just told you and a little bit about the consensus statement.
Be looking for it. Is it not possible even now to have your game development team create a downloadable iPhone app for NeuroRacer or Evo such that our friend at the refrigerator, 60 years old, can't remember that he came there to get a cold beer, can go through the stages of 12 hours of intensive multitasking exercise on the game? Yeah. Isn't that possible even now?
Yeah, so it is possible, and this is why I said it's sort of a polarizing decision, and I could understand your point, and I agree with it. The reason that is not happening is because, you have to remember, we're talking about a paradigm shift here, right? We're talking about the idea that a physician would reach into their pocket and pull out a prescription pad and write down a video, an iPad game, as freely as they would write down Adderall. It's a big deal. It has not happened. It may not happen. But Achille feels, and others, that that should happen, and the way to that for that to happen is to separate the consumer and the therapeutic, and that once this game is validated and goes through FDA approval, if you just keep it in a certain way, because you have to remember, it's not just the FDA approval that makes this happen. It's a psychology. It's a mind, you know, set. And so once you look at all the side effects, you really treat it like it's a drug that's now... You know, our study is not strong enough for me to tell you all to play that game. I don't feel that way, which is why I actually signed that consensus statement. I think that what we showed here is a signal that there's something important here, and it needs a lot more research and bigger studies to be done. And so what I think will happen is that hopefully we'll start seeing these games get locked away for a bit and get really validated very carefully, reach those endpoints, reach clinical markets, and then there'll be versions of the game that have a more consumer view that can be for education and other purposes. But no one knows the future, but at least that's part of the decisions. And I know, you know, some people might agree with it, some don't agree with it, but that's the goal. It's a really, really high-level goal. No one knows sure how to get there. No one's gotten there yet, but that's how we've decided to get there. Sorry.
This is so exciting. I might be able to actually beat a grandchild at a game. Two questions. Do you have tours of the Neuroscape lab? And the second question is, I thought that multitasking was really just serial focusing. Can you explain what multitasking is as opposed to really focusing?
So, we don't have official tours. I do give them at times, but it's largely a burden on the lab to do too many tours because they're trying to work, so they get disrupted every time I bring people through there. But maybe we'll try to arrange something more formally at some point. But if you go to our lab website, and you could find that by searching my name, you have my name, and you'll find it right away. We have a mailing list, and we might start doing some more formal public things for people in the area. Multitasking, you're right. Multitasking, we call it that because the behavior is to try to do more than one thing at a time. Sometimes your behavior is to try to do things serially. But it's true, when you do try to do more than one thing at a time and they're both attentionally demanding, you will have competition and your brain manages it by doing it serial. So from a neural perspective, what we see is task switching, but from a behavioral perspective, you're trying to do two things at one time. And that's what you're trying to do there. You're trying to multitask. You're trying to do that. But it's a complicated topic. I actually am working on a book that you could read next year. Maybe I'll come back here then. Yeah. I know. You've been asking me since day one. Where's my book? Yes. So maybe I'll be back here. So it should be in the fall of of next year. It's called The Distracted Mind. It's sort of like a much higher level view of what I did in the PBS show. And it's a really complicated story in some ways, because you saw here, I showed you that we could train multitasking to lead to these improvements. But a big message of the book is that multitasking is not good, right? Because it diminishes your performance. So the way I view it is that you should tailor your environment in such a way to maximize your interaction with the environment. And that often means having less distraction and doing one thing at a time. But you can't always do that, right? We know that. Sometimes you have to engage in a world that's more complicated, has more streams of information. When you're doing that, you should do it as best as you possibly can. And so that's why we do the training to improve cognitive control. So anyway, that's, you'll read about that more when I finally finish this book.
Brilliant work, absolutely mind-blowing. Just an observation on something we're doing. We've invented a technology where we can rebalance people that have MS, Parkinson's, cerebellar degeneration, with a specialized vest with little tiny weights on it. Cool. We're 85% effective, all comers. Don't care what the reason is. Stroke, we don't care.
Cool.
And that's wonderful, and it's doing terrific. It's called Balanceware. It's doing great. But the thing that's starting to get us really interested is we're seeing that we're reprogramming the brain in people in certain ways, where all of a sudden their cognitive function seems to be improving. We see that we're getting new activation patterns with MS, Parkinson's, or whatever, but now people are saying that they can hear better, they can see better, handwriting is noticeably improved. We're even seeing some fog removal. People that are pre-dementia, that are thinking better, responding better. We don't understand what's happening with this. I mean, cool.
Reach out to me. It sounds interesting.
Could I?
Sure.
Some pretty amazing stuff going on.
Sounds good.
I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance to answer the question. Have you seen any result in your work that would correlate with that?
We haven't. I don't know exactly the approach you're taking, but I mean, in general, we're interested in this interaction of the physical and the cognitive system. We know they interact. A lot of my colleagues that work on Parkinson's and MS are very excited about body brain training for that very reason. So in general, you know, there is all sorts of interactions that occur, and it's just careful to study it, you know, study as best you can.
This may almost be too basic, but you started out with the whole idea of enhancing cognition. And there was the old chestnut when we were younger that, you know, you only use 30% or some infinitesimal small amount of your brain. Are what you're doing in targeting the different areas, are you now able to see almost individually that, say, somebody who has depression, that deficit is X, and in another area that deficit is only X plus 5, and hence through this training, you're building those individual segments up?
Yeah, so I'll break it down a little bit, but it's a big one. So in general, that concept that we use a percentage of our brain is as much of a myth as we can ever imagine from a neuroscience perspective. You use all of your brain. I mean, you can't imagine the most complex structure in the entire universe having, like, you know, empty office space. No empty office space here. Every single bit of your brain is used pretty much all the time. Now you have your brain operating, and everyone does, but what really leads to higher order abilities and optimal performance are the network communications. Your brain is not acting as these isolated islands. It's acting as an integrated system of networks. And so that communication, and that's what we saw with NeuroRacer, we were able to change that network communication. So yes, it's true. We're looking to see how the building blocks of cognition that underlie these higher order abilities can be sculpted by these type of interactions. So that is our goal. One more.
Hi, thank you so much. So 3.5 hours ago, I was sitting under a NeuroStar RTMS machine, which saved my life a year ago from major depressive disorder, drug resistant. And so I've been through it. I've been through the ringer for many years, and this thing changed my life. And compared to what you're talking about, it's barbaric. You know, it's a bunch of magnets at one little, you know, my left prefrontal cortex, but it does make a difference. But I can also tell it's not making all the difference.
Yeah. I mean, you know, our TMS, we do a lot of it in our lab. There's some really amazing clinical work in depression and bipolar disorder and schizophrenia showing that it can have great clinical endpoints. We're trying to raise it several notches. So the main reason, the main way we're trying to do that is through these closed loop feedbacks. Like they're doing that, but right. they don't understand
exactly
what's going on in your brain.
Very little tracking.
But this is not. That's how everyone is doing. There's no exceptions to that. But that's
so my
that's
question is actually a little bit bigger because my career until losing everything to depression was a marketing strategist global. In fact, Nolan Bushnell was one of my clients in the 80s. You mentioned Pong.
Yeah.
Do you know Nolan?
Mm-hmm.
He's amazing. And I've gotten involved in the field or wanted to help the tens of millions of people who suffer like I did and run into this wall of ignorance. I call it the industry, which includes medical care, all the nonprofits, governmental organizations who really are busy fighting stigma. They point that, you know, that's the enemy, and they're not really working on solutions.
Do you have
any thoughts on all of that?
Yeah,
well, any thoughts on all of that? I mean, are there efforts supporting the work like yours, moving towards better solutions, moving towards better diagnostics?
Okay.
Because I'm hearing this war against stigma.
Yeah, I'll use that as a wrap-up point. So it's hard to find funding these days. The government funds less and less science every single year. It's pretty brutal. NIH is normally our main funding support. It's thinner than it's ever been. We have lots of NIH support. Most of our support is NIH, but it's less. We're really excited about engaging the local community. So we have lots of support this year from companies and philanthropists that want to see the type of work we're doing, which is not like classic conservative style NIH funding, as you might gather, right? But we think that this type of innovation, which is common in the tech industry, should be happening in neuroscience. So we're trying to invent a whole new funding strategy pathway so that we can do this work. So if anyone here wants to support it, I certainly won't turn it away. All right, thank you, everyone.